Accessory number 4799, rule number 4. Air Vice Marshal F.W. Long, rule number 4.
There were seven laps of the course, so the total distance flown was approximately 210 miles. I think it would be appropriate at this stage to say what this country gained from the experience in the Schneider Trophy. The aircraft were designed by R.J. Mitchell, Reginald Mitchell, who had been for quite a time, had designed various flying boats and had designed these racing seaplanes. The knowledge that he gained in designing these aircraft was immense, and it was due to his experience and the knowledge that he gained with these, for those days, very fast aircraft, enabled him to design as a private venture the Spitfire. A couple of months or so after the contest, John Boothman and I were asked to go down to the works at Southampton by Mitchell. We went down there and we said, "Well, Mitch, what is it you want us for?" And he said, "Well, I'd like you to come inside here and I'll show you something." And we went inside a special part of the hangar which had been cordoned off, and inside was the wooden mock-up a fighter that he thought would be just the job. And we were asked to give our opinion of the cockpit layout and various things of that sort, which we did. This was the progenitor of the Spitfire. The Spitfire first flew in 1935, flown by the chief test pilot of Vickers, who in those days was a man called Summers, as Munt Summers. Unfortunately, Mitchell tragically died at the early age of 42, and therefore did not live to see the outstanding success of this magnificent aeroplane during the war. Now, as regards the engine, Rolls-Royce acquired an enormous amount of knowledge and experience with designing this racing engine, particularly from the supercharging side and various other technical attributes. This enabled them to use this experience to design the Merlin engine, which started life developing 1,000 horsepower and ended up in the towards the end of the war in developing the best part of 2,000. Without that engine, I think it is true to say that we should have not won the air battle in the war, because it engined such aircraft as the Spitfire, the Hurricane, the Lancaster, the Mosquito, the P-51 American Mustang, and some Merlins, I think I'm right in saying, were fitted to bow fighters. In other words, without that engine, it is extremely unlikely, in my opinion, that we would have had the air supremacy which eventually we achieved. To give you some examples of the type of technique that was put into this racing engine, the crankcase was made of magnesium. The exhaust valves were filled with sodium. The stems of the exhaust valves were filled with sodium so that they didn't get too hot and cause pre-ignition. And it was all this expertise that they learnt in developing this engine that enabled them, as I say, eventually to produce the Merlin. If I may just regress for a moment to show the sort of thing that went on in the 1929 race, the day before the race itself, an airman was checking everything, and he took one of the sparking plugs out of the engine, and he found that it, he noticed that it had some white metal on it. He reported this, and it was obvious that something had serious had gone wrong inside that cylinder. The race, mind you, was the following day. You couldn't change the cylinder, of course. All you could do was to change the entire cylinder block, which was a major operation. A lot of mechanics had come down from Rolls-Royce at Derby to see the race the following day and were scattered about the town in various pubs and so on. The police were alerted, and these men were assembled, and they worked right throughout the night, and they changed the entire cylinder block of that engine. God knows how they did it, but they did do it. Dick Waghorn was never told, and the engine was run up the following day. It was found when they took the cylinder block off that the piston was badly scored, and there was no question about it that if we had flown with that engine, it would have given very serious trouble indeed. Anyway, as I say, Dick Waghorn was never told, and the following day he went round and won the race. And it was not until after he'd won it that he was told what in fact had been going on throughout the night. Well, that brings me to the end, I think, of the high-speed flight, except to say that the trophy and the S6B are now on permanent exhibition at the Science Museum in South Kensington, and anybody who is sufficiently interested, it's well worth a visit to have a look at them. I can only say that I count myself extremely fortunate to have had the luck to fly these aircraft, and it was an experience not to be equaled and one I shall never forget.
And one much to be envied by others, too. Then you went for a year or a couple of years to be the flight commander of 85 Squadron in 8.
Eight Squadron.
Ah, 8 Squadron. Mm. Yes, correct, sorry.
Is it still running?
Yep.
After the Schneider Trophy, I had a short leave and was then posted back to Farnborough, where I did quite a bit of flying for a couple of months, and then in February of 1932, I was posted as flight commander to Number 8 Squadron in Aden, where in those days it was a two-year station because the climate was supposed to be such that people didn't survive more than 2 years. There's not much to say about my time there. The squadron was equipped with a Fairey 3F aircraft, and the running of the country had been handed over to the RAF, and it was much the same sort of thing on a smaller scale than Iraq in the old days, and the Northwest Frontier doing demonstration flights over the hinterland and the tribes, and if they should cause any trouble, which very rarely they did, but just occasionally they did, then we would drop warning notices and the odd bomb to do a bit of harm to their villages. And this always brought them to heel, and very little trouble, if any, was caused at all. We did demonstration flights and flew political agents about the country. I remember one flight out to a place called Beihan, which was on the edge of the Rub el Khali, the great Arabian desert, and the country around there, and also the mountainous country of the interior of Aden, was extremely interesting, and I'm very glad to have had the opportunity to see it and appreciate that part of the world. The colony of Aden was directed from London, and the British resident in those days was Sir Bernard Riley, always known as Pop Riley. Why, I haven't the faintest idea. Towards the end of my time in Aden, I thought I would like to try and I would like to sit the Staff College examination. And so my commanding officer, who was also the commander-in-chief of all forces in Aden, Group Captain O.T. Boyd, said, well, if you'd like to pay your own passage, you can go home a little bit early and sit the Staff College exam in UK. I therefore begged, borrowed, or stole the money and paid my own passage home in a cargo ship carrying copra. So the whole ship was riddled with copra beetles, and life was not particularly pleasant. At any rate, it got me safely home, and I sat the Staff College exam in midwinter at Uxbridge.
What sort of aeroplane was the Fairey 3F?
The Fairey 3F, as the name implies, was designed by the Fairey Aviation Company. It was a general-purpose bomber and reconnaissance aircraft. It was powered by a 450-horsepower Napier Lion engine, and had a somewhat indifferent performance, but was good enough for the job. It was also could be fitted with floats and used as a float plane, which in fact it was at one time when the squadron first went to Aden. The airfield at Aden was about 5 or 6 miles outside the main port of Aden, and the name of the airfield was Cormaxa, which I believe is used by the Russians today.
And what happened next in your career after the Staff College exam?
After the Staff College exam, which I had the fortune to pass, I was posted as a regular adjutant and chief flying instructor to number 604 Auxiliary Squadron at Hendon. There were three auxiliary squadrons at Hendon, 600, 601, and 604. I was there for a year, in 1934, and one's work consisted of the administration of the squadron itself, teaching numbers of young and extremely keen young men to fly. We were equipped with Lynx-engined Avros to do the flying instruction, and the operational aircraft of the squadron was the Western Wapiti, which in due course was replaced by the Hind. And so one had a certain amount of conversion training to do as well. We had a town headquarters in Hampstead, and you couldn't have wished for a more keen and full-out crowd of chaps than we had. Once a year, in the summer, we went to annual camp, which in our case was at Tangmere, where there was an RAF fighter squadron, and there we were able to practice interceptions with it was number one squadron, I think, as far as I remember, and I flew one of their Hawker Furies, with which they were equipped in those days, which was then the fastest single-seater fighter in the Air Force. And incidentally, it was about 180 miles an hour slower than the S-6B. So it didn't seem a particularly fast airplane to me. However, the squadron was, of course, incorporated in the war, when the war broke out, and one of the, amongst others as well, of course, better-known members of the squadron, who was a member there when I was adjutant, was, as he became later, Group Captain John Cunningham, who became the famous night fighter pilot and got three DSOs and two DFCs. There were many, many others who distinguished themselves as well during the war, and I was very, very fortunate and much appreciate and was very lucky to have had the job of running that squadron. The CO, of course, was an auxiliary, and in case of 604 Squadron, he was a squadron leader, Alan Dore, D-O-R-E, who'd been a pilot during the First War, and you could not have wished for a nicer man to work with. He said he would like to. He was a bit out of touch with flying, and he said he would like to go solo in a heart. I gave him some dual in a dual heart, and I considered that he was just on the borderline of being capable of flying the thing successfully. So I said, off you go, turned away and shut my eyes, metaphorically, and all was well, and he was able to fly this aeroplane round Hendon and land without breaking anything. Well, that brings me to the end of the my time at Hendon.
Sorry, one very point here. These pilots, of course, just flew on Saturdays and Sundays.
Yes. I should have said that the flying was done almost entirely over the weekend. We, the regular staff, got a day off in the middle of the week. I think it was Tuesday, as far as I remember. And we worked all the weekend. And, of course, if any of the members of the squadron could get out during the week and wanted a bit of flying instruction, as long as they didn't come on my day off, then, of course, we were available to give them that. But 90% of the work and the flying was done on Saturday and Sunday.
And the next stage?
Well, after that, that took me up to the end of 1934, and I was told that I had passed the Staff College examination and that I had been selected to attend the Staff College course starting in January 1935. The Staff College was then at Andover. It was the Commandant was Air Vice Marshal, as he then was, Air Vice Marshal Wilfred Freeman, who became Air Marshal Sir Wilfred Freeman during the war and Deputy Chief of the Air Staff. I spent an extremely interesting year there. It was hard work, but it was very interesting. We had some very good directing staff, one of whom was later became Air Marshal. One of whom was Saunby, who was the Deputy CNC of Bomber Command. And so we were fortunate in having a very good staff to teach us. They kept our nose to the grindstone, made us work pretty hard, but it taught one a lot how to write properly, how to express oneself, how to give a lecture, and also the problems facing this country vis-a-vis other countries not so very long before war broke out. The course ended at the end of the year. One was able to do a little bit of flying because we had a few training aircraft at Andover, and so one was able to keep one's hand in doing a bit of flying occasionally. I was then at the end of the Staff College course. I was promoted to squadron leader and was posted to, needless to say, to a staff job in the Air Ministry.
Could I just ask one question there? When you were at the Staff College and being lectured by important men in 1935, was there any beginning of a realization of what might lie ahead of us 4 years afterwards?
From the point of view of the war, you mean?
Yes.
The war breaking out? From memory, I would say no. I don't think that anybody realized then in 1936 how imminent the war was, or what a world menace Hitler was, and it wasn't until a bit later, in sort of 37 and 38, that it became obvious to the Munich intelligence that to all intents and purposes war was inevitable, and the only thing to do was to rearm and build up the Royal Air Force just as hard as we could go.
And of course that's exactly what you were very much involved with, I imagine, when you went to be into the Directorate of Organisation in the Air Ministry.
Yes, I was posted to the organisation side of the Air Ministry. The Air Ministry was then at the Daspel House in Kingsway, and the Director General of Organisation, not when I first got there, but shortly after I got there, was a certain Group Captain Portal, who, as we all know, became Sir Charles Portal and eventually Lord Portal, who was Chief of the Air Staff for the majority of the war. In fact, I can't remember exactly, but I think he took over as the CAS when the war broke out was Newell, and I think Portal took over from him towards the the latter part of 1940, but I wouldn't be absolutely certain of those dates. We were busy at the Air Ministry then in building up under various schemes C, D, F, and everything else, the new airfields and new squadrons, and working with the Ministry of Aircraft Production to see just as fast as we could go, building up both the bomber squadrons. Of course, we hadn't got the Lancaster in those days, but we had got the Hurricanes and Spitfires, albeit in extremely limited numbers. But we did form, and I do remember these figures, we did form before the war broke out. Some of them were rather skeleton squadrons, but we had 14 Hurricane squadrons and 7 Spitfire squadrons. New airfields were opened up all over the country. Various factories run by Morris Motors and other firms were turned over to aircraft production instead of whatever work they had been employed on in peacetime. And I can assure you that everything that could conceivably be done to build up and expand the Royal Air Force between 1936 and the outbreak of war in 39 had been done. Money had become practically no object, and we did just everything we possibly could do in the time available, which heaven knows was short enough. But we did get away with it by the skin of our teeth, as everybody knows, and were able to save this country during the Battle of Britain, with, of course, the help of the scientists who enabled us to have, at the outbreak of war, the radar chain, which enabled the fighter squadrons to be directed onto enemy aircraft instead of having to do standing patrols, and without which there's little doubt that we should not have won the Battle of Britain. It was largely because of the scientists who had enabled the radar chain along the south and southeast coast of the country to be set up and to be in full operation when the war broke out, and the control exercised by 11 Group and Fighter Command.
Well, Air Marshal, that's a 20-year story of enormous challenge and excitement, adventure and change. Thank you very much indeed for recording it.
Not at all. It's been a pleasure, and it's brought it back to me in a way perhaps that nothing else could have done, and I hope it may be of some interest to some people, and I'm very grateful for having had the opportunity of doing it.
Thank you.